across America and around the world. Welcome to America's number one veterans program, the voice of America's veterans, Veterans Radio. And now your host for today's program, former CB, July 66, Republic of Vietnam, Gary Lilly.
Good morning, Bob. Representing the 101st Airborne, trained as a forward observer, put to work as a medic. It's the military way.
Hoorah!
Good morning to that thin green and blue line out there protecting us and the rest of the world. That's our military of today. You're doing a great job. We older veterans are proud of you. My veteran brothers and sisters, welcome home. And to you folks down under, thanks for listening in. And good morning, America. Welcome to Veterans Radio. This is about our 270th, over 5 years. How many times programs, Bob? About 270, 275?
Oh, no, we're over 300.
Over 300?
Yeah.
Time flies.
Yeah.
Time flies.
It's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah.
A lot of things.
It's a great day for veterans, and when you see a veteran, thank them. When you see somebody in a uniform, active duty military, thank them. And make it sincere. These people are good. You and I went up to Camp Grayling and watched them train the Michigan National Guard.
You know, it has changed. Not that my perspective hadn't been toward professional, but to see it firsthand and to watch the professional. I was looking at my photographs that I took there, and all the things that I saw reminded me on how confident I felt being around those troops, how professional they were.
America, you can rest easy and be comfortable. We're in good hands. Those troops today are superb.
Well, what a great segue, because I was watching television yesterday, and, I know, saw the movie Stripes. I'm telling you, folks, that's not the way it is. That's the Beetle Bailey Army. That certainly is not the way it is. The disrespect, all you veterans that are out there know that never, ever, ever happened at any of the repo stations. Absolutely never. But now to see the soldiers being professional, going out, risking their lives, risking their very selves for America, and then seeing that kind of garbage on television. If you get a chance, write your station. Tell them what you feel about it. They don't need to show programs like that.
Hollywood ought to start mocking themselves, because it would be more appropriate. Our troops should not be mocked. They are when you take that oath, you're signing a blank check. That includes your life. You know, who are we to mock them?
And I don't believe that that's really comedy or humor. Yeah, it's sort of high school scatological. How's that for a word?
Yeah, right.
I said scatological.
Good. We can joke about ourselves, but not you.
Not you, exactly. So, anyway.
What's going on over there in EMU? What's coming up?
There's another great segue. I want to tell everybody about September the 5th, Saturday, September the 5th at Reinerson Stadium. It's going to be West Point versus the Eastern Michigan Eagles. Yes, a football game. Kickoff at 7 o'clock.
And who's going to be there?
We're going to be there, and we're going to be doing a program. That's right. If you want to get yourself on Veterans Radio and be a part of this wonderful event, we have 100 tickets to the tailgate party, 100 tickets, and we'd like you all who would be interested in going, starting with going on to our website, www.veteransradio.net, be sure it's .net, and email us, tell us how many tickets you'd like. Tailgate party starts at 4. There will be refreshments, there will be hot dogs, hamburgers, potato chips, pop, water. Did I miss anything besides us?
You missed priorities. Our priorities are going to be to the troops of today and their families, and to hospitalized veterans, right?
Yes. Parking, by the way, for the tailgate, which begins at 4 o'clock. This is our tailgate. We're going to have a tent. As I said, the refreshments, etc., the parking is free. You'll be directed to parking. Admission to the tailgate is free for the veterans and their families. As I said, we have 100 tickets to give away, and we certainly like to get them away as soon as possible. Our program will be recording approximately 5 to 6 in the afternoon. Come on down and be a part of it. And if you happen to not be one of the first 100 that we give away the tickets to, there's going to be a special price of $3 to get in the game and to be part of the tailgate. And every ticket that's sold as part of this particular project slash program, $1 will benefit the EMU ROTC program. So once again, we're going to be telling you lots about this Saturday, September 5th. Happens to be Labor Day weekend, right here in Ypsilanti, Michigan. The Army versus Eastern Michigan, the Army Cadets, Eastern Michigan Eagles. Kickoff at 7 o'clock, and we're going to have tailgate at 4. We'll be giving you more information.
It's going to be fun. We got troops coming home today, do we?
Yes, we do. Each week on Veterans, thank you, Gary, each week. Oh, I know, I'm shuffling papers here as we go along. Each week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home servicemen and women who've been stationed around the world in the service of our country. After a year overseas, Fort Benning, Georgia saw the 988th Military Company coming home. Approximately 50 soldiers with the 988th will return from Iraq and arrive at Fort Benning, Georgia. While deployed, the 988th mentored and trained Iraqi police force. This was the military police company's third deployment. The company also spent 6 months in 2002 guarding prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Dateline, the Keystone State. The largest Pennsylvania National Guard contingent sent into combat since World War II will stream home from Iraq one plane load at a time. Advanced elements of the 4,000-member 56th Stryker Brigade combat team will start the homeward journey within days. The entire brigade should be back by late next month. Colonel Mark Ferraro said yesterday in an interview from Camp Taji, northwest of Baghdad, said his troops, and I quote, have exceeded every expectation in carrying a heavy load of responsibility rarely given to a guard unit. That fits right in, Gary, what we talked about when we were covering the guard there at Grayling's.
Exactly.
Isn't that something?
Yep.
Since late February, the 56th has been in charge of security in a wide swath of territory northwest of Baghdad. They were working to put down a diminishing Iraqi insurgency. They also built up the capabilities of the Iraqi army and even expanded the electrical supply in the region. That's another thing, too, I wanted to point out. This National Guard unit, the engineers, they're bringing electricity, bringing comfort back to
water,
the civilians.
Bringing water.
Absolutely. Water,
cool.
Electricity.
You bet.
I'm going to further quote the colonel. I think our major accomplishment is our partnership with the Iraqi army. We have seen them grow in many areas. That's also good to hear. Great stuff. The 56th is the only one of the Army's seven elite Stryker brigades to be contained within a guard division. The Stryker is a recent type of combat vehicle that looks like a tank but rolls on wheels instead of tracks. Once again, the colonel and I quote, I think we have proven the concept that a Stryker brigade can exist within the National Guard. Everybody's back home can be extremely proud of these soldiers.
Duty, honor, country. The world is supported by four things only: the learning of the wise, the justice of the great, the prayers of the righteous, the valor of the brave. To your own self be true. Medal of Honor recipient, Samuel Davis, 2001. Sammy, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, sir. Good to join you.
And I want to point out to people, it is not a winner. You do not win the Medal of Honor. It was not a sporting contest. You are a recipient of the Medal of Honor. Is that right, Sammy?
That's fact, sir. Yes, sir.
That was pointed out to me one time, and I have never forgotten it. A fellow from the Korean War who was awarded the Medal of Honor. And I said that. I understand you won the Medal of Honor. He said, I was a recipient of the Medal of Honor, son. It was not a sporting contest.
Yes, sir. Very true.
Sam, you're from Kansas, aren't you?
No, sir. I'm from Flat Rock, Illinois.
Oh, really?
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
Not far away from here.
Not too far.
You enlisted in the Army right out of high school?
Yes, sir. Went to Vietnam on my senior trip.
Some people go to Cancun. A lot of people don't realize this, but close between two-thirds and three-quarters of those who served in Vietnam, and closer to three-quarters, were volunteers. And the popular image is that everybody was dragged over there kicking and screaming. You were in the artillery. Your dad was in World War II, and so you volunteered for the artillery, did you?
Yes, sir. Wanted to follow in my dad's footsteps.
Where did he serve?
In Europe. World War II.
Yep. What unit was he with? Do you remember? What army?
No, sir. Not at the moment.
Okay. Good. Now, listen, I should be calling you, sir. What are some of the honors that are extended to a Medal of Honor recipient, Sammy?
Some of the honors that are extended to it?
Right.
It's obligations more than honors, I believe. I have attended every presidential inauguration since Lyndon Johnson. And there again, it is an honor to attend, but they expect you to attend to represent we the people. That's how it was described by me many, many years ago by Eddie Rickenbacker, actually.
Really? You met him?
Yes, sir. Oh, certainly. Yes, sir.
Does somebody in the military salute the Medal of Honor? I don't remember that anymore.
Even the president salutes the Medal of Honor first.
Isn't that amazing? That for people to get an idea of, you're a part of a very select group of a very select group. What's the percentage of Medal of Honor recipients that receive it posthumously? Do you know that?
Currently, I believe we have 98 living recipients, and there's been 3,470, I believe. Don't quote me exactly on that number, but there's been several received, but only 98 living.
Right. Going back to the Civil War, in the Civil War, most of them were awarded for capturing the other side's flag, which was quite important, especially in those days. Do I remember right that over 50% of those awarded the Medal of Honor receive it posthumously?
Well, at least that, yes, sir.
Yeah. You're part of an elite group of an elite group, or a minority of an elite group. But tell us about, let's jump right into what happened. It was in, how do you pronounce it, Kilai? What was the town that you were west of down in, you were in South Vietnam.
Kilai. Southernmost portion of Vietnam, down in Kilai, right off the Mekong River.
And not that far from the Cambodian border. You were with your artillery unit, and as I read, 11 guns and 42 men were helicoptered into an area west of Kilai to set up a forward fire support base. How many of you all told were there at that fire support base?
In our unit, there were 42. We only had four guns. D battery, which was the battery that they had devised these platforms that had hydraulic legs on them, and they moved in just off our port side and set them up in a rice paddy, and they were 400 or 500 yards at least from us, and then we were set up right on riverbank, and we had four 105 howitzers.
How many men were there besides your 42?
Well, I didn't know how many was in D battery. We had 42 with us. That's what was running our guns.
And how many? You started taking mortar fire, heavy mortar fire, about 2 in the morning. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And that was followed immediately or concurrently by an attack from
at 2:30 exactly, the mortar stopped and the ground assault waves started.
It was Viet Cong. And they were good fighters too. The NVA was from the north. We were fighting two armies. Most people don't know that we were fighting the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong, which were the South Vietnamese, as they say, guerrillas. But how many hit you? Do you know?
it was a reinforced heavy weapons battalion of NVA. Now, I know it says in the citation that they were Viet Cong. You did not ever see 1,500 Viet Cong in one spot all dressed in uniforms.
Well, that caught me by surprise, and I thought, well, it's there it is in writing. So they were NVA.
No, sure, just politically expedient. It was not politically expedient in 1967 to admit that there were that many NVA in the southernmost portion of Vietnam.
Okay,
so they became Viet Cong.
Okay, that makes sense. Political correctness even then, or politics even then, not political correctness, but politics.
And we accounted for at least 20 Red Chinese advisors.
In that battle?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so you were hit by roughly how many North Vietnamese soldiers?
Reinforced battalion, about 1,500.
1,500. All attacking your battery of four guns and 42 men?
Yes, sir.
That's a fierce battle. So tell us what happened then. Where did they come from? Were they coming from the other side of the river, or were they all around you?
Originally, they started from just across the river, and then they started coming in from all sides. If it had not been for the Beehive Round, which is a flechette round that the 105 Howitzer has, none of us would have been able to make it through. But the Beehive Round accomplished its mission.
For the folks out there that don't know what Sammy's talking about, there was a round that was similar to the grape shot of the Civil War days, except that it had 18,000 beehive darts in each shell, little darts.
They're just little arrows is what they look like, got little fins on them and everything.
Right, and the guns were, the barrels were lowered to horizontal position and fired directly into the enemy, and they were destructive.
Extremely destructive.
How many rounds a minute could your guns fire doing that?
I believe under sustained fire you can fire 3 a minute, but when you're getting overrun by 1,500 of the enemy, you don't pay a lot of attention as to how many you're supposed to be able to fire a minute, and you fire and load them as quickly as you can.
The adrenaline speeds up the process a little bit, I guess.
Yes, sir.
But you took over a machine gun at that point, did you not?
Yes, sir. That was what I grabbed a hold of first, because they had hit my howitzer with a rocket and had blown it up and blown us away from the gun. And so my first response was, I've got to do something. So I grabbed a machine gun. And when I ran out of ammunition for the machine gun, I fired my M16 until I ran out of bullets. And the only thing left was the 105 howitzer that was all blown up and burning. And I thought, well, maybe I can just get one round out of it. So I found a beehive round and assembled it and put it together. And on the next mass assault wave, I fired the beehive round, and the howitzer came back over me because the recoil mechanism was totally blown off of the weapon. So it ran over me. But I seen that it was it had done its job. It had taken the brunt of the enemy and wiped him out. So I thought, well, maybe I can do one more round. So I didn't put quite as much powder in the succeeding rounds, and it worked much better.
That's another thing that with guns of that size, you put in the projectile, and then you put in bags of powder behind it, right?
Yes, sir.
It's kind of amazing. I think the bags of powder are in strings of 5 bags, and you cut off what you want to use, and you discard the rest.
In a 105 howitzer, there are 7 bags of powder sewn together on a cotton string. And it depends on how far you want to shoot is how many bags of powder you put in.
How many did you put in with that first round?
Well, because I could not find any of the bags of powder, which that's the way we had been trained. I'd never put loose powder in. All of the powder had been hit by the bullets and the mortars, and there was no bags. It was just loose powder. So I was scooping it up, and the first round that I fired, I filled the canister full of loose powder. which when you put the 7 bags of powder in the canister, it does fill the canister, but there's a lot of air holes because of the bags. But when I filled it full, that's one of the reasons why it ran over me so aggressively. And later, Fort Sill, Oklahoma, the home of the artillery for the Army, said that, well, son, you probably fired a charge 20 in a cannon that, in excellent condition, 7 is a maximum charge. So that's why the first round was a duel.
He thought he fired out to the horizon. So you fired the second round, and you kept on firing until you ran out of rounds. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I fired everything that I could find.
And you ended up, what was the last one you fired?
A propaganda round.
So your last, this is almost like the last round you fired was a bunch of leaflets?
Yes, sir.
Did it do anything?
Most definitely.
changed the mind of some of them, I guess.
I changed the mind of several of them, yes, sir.
All right, so then when you ran out of ammunition for the howitzer, where was your crew at that point? You were the only one firing, is that operating it, is that right?
Yes, sir.
What happened to your crew?
Wounded. Some had fallen back on one of the other guns to help them. They didn't, in that extent of a combat situation, your world becomes very, very small.
Right.
I know I thought that I was the only one left alive for my unit. I thought everybody else was gone. And in talking with the other men the next morning, well, they were each concerned with their own small bit of the perimeter. You know, you didn't have time to stand up and look around and say, well, I wonder what Sam's doing or whatever. You know, you were busy tending to business at your area. And that's what I was doing, and that's what they were doing.
And the noise is ferocious.
Oh, the noise is unreal.
And they had tracers coming, right? Green, were they green?
Well, their tracers were white, blue, or green.
Okay.
And on which communist nation was supporting that particular effort. And that night, it must have been well supported because we could see red, white, blue, green tracers going everywhere.
And
the reds were ours.
The red were ours, right. I remember having a green tracer go by me one time, and I kind of was afraid to say that later on to people because I thought, well, tracers are red. And then I learned that, well, that was one of their tracers.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. We didn't get shot at very often, thankfully. In a combat situation, it is kind of like controlled madness, you guys were all
not,
doing
not so controlled.
What's that?
Sometimes it's not so controlled, it's just madness.
Yeah, and you guys were just reacting to your training and the will to live.
We were doing our job, taking care of each other and doing our job.
Yeah, you know, I've said that more times on this program. Someday I'm going to figure out what that term just doing our job means. When when it involves machine gun fire coming at you and doing the things that you guys do, I've heard more guys say, "I was just doing my job." That really works my mind. I really want to tell you,
you're taking care of your brother in the same manner that you would want them to take care of you. That is your job.
There you go. The brother alongside of you. That's what you're fighting
for,
right? So, and speaking of the brother alongside of you and taking care of your brother alongside of you, at some point you heard yelling from the other side of the river?
Yes, sir. Gwendell Holloway stood up and said, "Don't shoot, I'm a GI." And I just was devastated to the fact that I'd been firing beehive all night at my brother.
What were they doing on the other side of the river?
They were with 5th to the 60th Recon. They had set up the perimeter around our fire support base. They were providing our security. So that's why they were over there.
You weren't aware that they were over there?
Yes, sir. We knew they were over there, but we had been told that when the enemy attacked us, that all of our guys were back within our circle.
Okay. So they started yelling, and what took place then?
I had to go get him. You know, you don't leave your brother across the river.
You can't swim.
So devised a method to go get him, which by that point my body was in pretty sad shape. I'd been shot with bullets and beehive and had shrapnel wounds all over me, and I thought, well, I better find a piece of an air mattress. So I found an air mattress and blew it up and tied it off closest to the blow-up nozzle that I could that didn't have any bullet holes or any holes in it. And sure enough, I thought, well, that'll hold enough air to get me across the river, and it did. And I made my way to where I had last seen Gwendell stand and wave his boonie hat at me. And when I reached that location, there were two more men in a foxhole. So there were three guys instead of just one, and it had taken me about 45 minutes to make my way across the river and then crawl up through the jungle back to where I'd seen Gwendell. And I knew I didn't have the physical strength left to make three separate trips, so I asked the man above to give me the strength to carry all three of my brothers at one time. So the worst wounded, Jim Dyster, was shot right through the head. I picked him up and put him across my shoulders. Billy Ray Crawford from Alvin, Texas, picked up Billy Ray. Now, Billy Ray had lost, I think it was his left leg, but Gwendell had put a tourniquet on it so he could still help. And Gwendell had been shot in the back and had been shot in the head, or had a shrapnel wound in the head, but he was still doing okay. So we all helped each other back across the battlefield till I got to the river, and then I started ferrying them back across one at a time.
Now, did you take a weapon with you? Because I understand you stood up and fired into the jungle to suppress the enemy at that point.
At that time, I did not have a weapon. I did not have any ammunition. It wasn't until I got to Gwendell's foxhole. He still had three clips of ammunition left for his 16, because he didn't think it was too wise to, you know, he is dead in the middle of 1,500 NVA. He didn't think it was a good idea for one man to stand up and start shooting at him, so he was just trying to hide.
Right. Exercising a little bit of common sense.
Yes, sir.
You were badly wounded. You had holes all over your body. You took an air mattress that had holes all over it, and you went across the river to retrieve these badly wounded guys, and on top of everything else, you can't swim.
Oh, no, sir. I've always swam like a fish. It was just because my body was in bad shape that I couldn't swim.
Okay. I'd always heard you couldn't swim. Well, we're unbelievable.
I had an inability to swim. I believe in the citation that's what it says. It's my inability to swim.
Okay.
Doesn't mean I didn't know how. It just means my body wasn't working good.
All right. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We're coming up on a break. We'll be right back.
Over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Staff Sergeant Rudolph Davila landed at Anzio to little resistance, but that didn't last. Details after this. Davila's unit moved quickly into a mountain pass leading to Rome. When the supply lines became overextended, they were ordered back to the beach. German artillery began firing down on the Americans, making Anzio a bloody battleground for weeks. On May 28th, Davila's squad had moved back into the mountains and was ambushed by Germans dug into high ground. Davila scrambled toward the crest of the hill, yelling for his men to follow, but they continued to hug the ground. He ordered them to pass him a tripod, machine gun, and ammunition. He assembled the weapon and raked the enemy position until he'd used up several 250-round ammo containers. He jumped on a disabled tank to use the 50 caliber, but it had been removed. Spotting snipers in a house on his left, he began shooting his rifle. He jumped down from the tank and ran into the house, found the snipers dead, and then began shooting at the machine gun emplacements across the road. He received a battlefield commission, and 56 years later, he was awarded the Medal of Honor by President William Clinton. The Medal of Honor series is produced by Veterans Radio.
We're back on Veterans Radio with Sammy Davis, Medal of Honor recipient for action in Vietnam. On 31 March 2000, this email was sent by Jim Dyster. Hello, I tuned into your website on SAM at the advice of one of my friends. It is a very good website. I was the most seriously wounded soldier that he brought back across the river. SAM is one of the bravest individuals that I know, although he will only tell you that he was doing what was right. He has a lot of integrity. Thanks again, Jim Dyster, Salina, Kansas. So the one who was the most seriously wounded lived.
Yes, sir, he did.
Thanks to you and the docs and the nurses. But thanks to you, he got a chance to go to the docs and nurses.
That's a fact, yes, sir.
Have you met Jim Deister since the war?
Oh, yes, sir. We've definitely become brothers. We see each other a couple times a year, sometimes more often.
Okay, what does it make you feel when you see him? Is it...
Like seeing family? This May, I was out in Stockton, California, where Gwendell Holloway lives. And I got to spend some time with Gwendell. Now, I don't get to see him as often as I do Jim Deister, but it was good. One of the lieutenants that was across the river, he was the lieutenant in charge of the 5th or the 6th, Lee Alley from Wheatland, Wyoming. Get to see Lee, well, usually every year or two anyway.
So all three of those men lived?
Say again?
All three of those men lived.
Oh, yes, sir. No, sir. I apologize. Lee was not one of the three men that I swam across the river for. Lee was their commander.
Okay.
And he survived. No, sir. Billy Ray Crawford from Alvin, Texas, did not survive the war. He survived the war. He did not survive the peace. He came home and self-medicated himself, and he was a black man from Alvin, Texas. Come home a disabled veteran, and I would call down and talk to him, and he'd say, "Yeah, Sam, everything's doing good." And it wasn't until later that I found out that things weren't doing that good.
Awfully sad. Brave, good men. Awfully
yes,
sad.
Sir.
Okay. How you got all three of them across at the same time?
No, sir. I carried Jim Deister across first, and then when I got to our bank, Bill Murray and Frank Gage jumped in the river and helped get Jim Deister up out of the water, and then I immediately went back across. Gwendell and Billy Ray could both hold on to the air mattress, so my job was somewhat easier, and I ferried them back across. Then once again, Bill Murray from Lenore, North Carolina, and Frank Gage from Buffalo, New York, helped get them out and got us all squared away, and we kind of took care of each other medically. And then that's when I decided I'd try to crawl on back and help one of the other artillery pieces that was still firing. So that's what I did. I couldn't do much, but I did help.
Okay, you were full of holes. You rescued three guys. You went across that river a couple of times. You stood up and fired on the other side of the river. All this time, the attack was still going on. Is that right?
Oh, certainly. Yes, sir.
Well, you wouldn't have had to go help the other artillery crew if it wasn't. How long did that attack last, Sammy?
They didn't break contact until about 8 o'clock in the morning, as I recall. And I believe by 9 o'clock we were starting to get dust-offs in, and so we had to do triage. You know, as kids with absolutely no medical experience, we had to evaluate who's going to live if they got medical treatment right now. And that's one of my nightmares. Did I make the right decisions?
How old were you?
I had just turned 21 years old just a few days before that night.
The awesome, awesome responsibilities and experience and that our young people carried out in those days and still do. I think we're a little bit younger than the troops today with the all-volunteer army. It's hard for me to imagine looking at young people today. You know, I hear a lot of guys say, I look at my son and I think I was killing bad guys at that age, or you know, carrying an M16 at that age. I remember looking around at I was old. I was 25. My squad leader was 25, but nobody else in the squad was old enough to drink. Go through a war and come back and you're not even old enough to drink. And in those days, not old enough to vote.
My sergeant, James Gant, he was an old man. He had been in the Army all of his life, and he was 27.
Okay. Now, I'm going to skip around a little bit right now. You played the harmonica over there.
Yes, sir. That's where I learned how to play the harmonica. My mother had sent me one because of the letters that I was writing home. I didn't want to worry Mom, so I would write about the beautiful sunrises and the beautiful sunsets and how the mud smelled and what she thought was that I was bored, so she sent me a harmonica. It hopes that, hope this helps you be not quite so bored. That note should still be on the original harmonica in the Medal of Honor Museum at Patriots Point, South Carolina.
Is that right? Well, I remember with my folks, I would ask for socks in every letter that I wrote home, and years later my dad said, well, you know, we were always asking if you needed anything, but you never needed anything. And I said, well, that's not true. I ask you for socks. Every letter I sent home, he said, yeah, we saw that, but we figured if you wanted socks, why didn't you just go buy some? So,
people anyway, don't understand.
No, thankfully. You had a sergeant that asked you to learn to play Shenandoah.
Yes, sir, Johnston Dunlop.
And what would he say to you when he would walk past?
He'd say, play it again, Sam. So he would sit down. John and I went through basic training together. He was prior service. So immediately out of basic training, he made E5. And then in Vietnam, we met up again, and he was with the 5th Cav, 9th Infantry Division. And John was the one going out and gathering the intelligence that would ultimately end up sending us to a certain location because the enemy was there. So John would come into our perimeter and find me and say, Sam, play it for me. So I would sit there and I would play Shenandoah. John was from New York, Avery, New York, as I recall, and he would drive down to the Shenandoah River Valley when he was a young man and sit on this same rock and hang his feet over the ledge and look down into the water below, and he said, Sam, you can see trout this big, and the water was just so clean and clear, and he would mention the soft hint of pine. He says, can't, not real strong, but just a soft hint of pine and always the cool breeze, and that's where I go in my heart when I want to relax. And when you play the song Shenandoah on your harmonica, it helps my heart get there quicker.
Well, awfully lonesome days. And what happened to John?
Johnston was killed in Vietnam.
So many good people, so many. Is there anything that you wanted to say about the battle that took place in the battle in the last 2.5 minutes of this segment?
Although I am the one that received the Medal of Honor, I think it's so unfair to the rest of the men that were there that night, because if one Medal of Honor was awarded, they all deserved a Medal of Honor because we all took care of each other. We all did what we had to do in our immediate area to take care of each other. And I don't know why. Of course, it was the other 11 men that put me in for the Medal of Honor. But I think they all should have the Medal of Honor. I think Lee Alley should have the Medal of Honor. I think, you know, they all earned it. If I earned it, they earned it, because we were all doing the same thing.
But you must have done a little bit different if you're the men that you were with put you in for the Medal of Honor.
Well, yes, sir. I
guess you did, huh?
Deeply appreciated their belief in me.
And you were told that you were going back to the United States, is that right?
When I woke up in the hospital in Yokohama, Japan, yes, sir, they told me they were going to send me home and retire me from the Army because of my injuries, and I told them I didn't want to go home, I didn't want to retire from the Army, I wanted to go back to Vietnam and be with my brothers. And General Westmoreland had just given me a pair of boots a few weeks before that night. And that's what I was basing this great friendship between General Westmoreland and I on at that time. And I told him, I said, General Westmoreland and I are close friends. You call him, he won't send me home. Well, they did. And Westy called back, and they came on a stretcher and carried me down to the colonel's office, and I spoke to Westmoreland, and he kind of let me ramble on for a little while, and then he said, well, son, what is it that I can do for you? And I explained to him, I said, well, sir, they're going to send me home and retire me from the Army, and I just want to go back to Vietnam and be with my brothers. And he said, well, son, let me talk to your colonel. We'll see if we can do that. And I got to go back to Vietnam, and I spent my remaining tour with my guys.
What do you think of General Westmoreland?
He was a friend, a confidant. He treated me like a son, and I loved him like a father.
He had a hard job, and there's a lot of Vietnam vets that are, you know, I think it's natural you're going to, the guy on top you know, he takes the blame and he takes the credit. But when you're on the bottom, it's the blame. When you're on the top, I guess it's the credit. But he was well-loved to this day by the troops. We're coming up on a break, and we'll be right back with our last segment. We're back on Veterans Radio with Sammy Davis, the A Medal of Honor recipient from the Vietnam War. Amazing story. Anyone that won, anybody that received the Medal of Honor, it's an amazing story. I've met a few. Did you ever meet Roy Benavides, Sammy?
Certainly, yes, sir. Roy and I went on several speaking tours together.
You always picture, I've always pictured a Medal of Honor recipient as this giant of a man. And boy, I met Roy, and he didn't come up to my shoulders.
But he was a giant of a man.
There you go. I guess it's how tall you are inside your insides.
It's your heart, yes, sir.
Yep. Westmoreland, going back to him, I just wanted to make a comment after the comments I made before. Pretty interesting. I've heard from people that knew General Westmoreland that even though he served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, he always considered himself a Vietnam vet.
Yes, sir.
And I guess we were his boys. Another thing about the man that you rescued who later on committed suicide, I guess, whether it was the slow or the fast method, society, it's up to you to help these people coming home from war to heal. And we've got people coming home from war right now, and one of the things that helps them heal is simply saying thank you for the job you've done. And that way you know that it wasn't just in vain, that there are people who appreciate it.
Yes, sir. It's important that we get them to talk about it, because one of the mistakes that was made with the Vietnam veterans, I remember the VA telling me to just forget about it. It wasn't important. And because I could not forget about it, I thought I was defective. I thought I was crazy. And when you think you're crazy, you will do crazy things. So let's circumvent all these problems and let our kids coming home today know that it is okay to talk about it. In fact, we need to talk about it so we can move it from in front of us and put it beside us. And because you will carry it with you all of your life, but you don't want it to be in front of you to keep you from going forward. You want it beside you so you can drag it with you, because you do indeed drag it with you everywhere you go.
It is with you every day of your life. And the funny thing about it is, I don't know if you've noticed it, but the word or Vietnam comes to me every day in my life, whether it's somebody making a comment, whether it's somebody on the radio or a movie or in the newspaper. The word Vietnam is always there.
Yes,
and,
sir.
It'll leap out at us like a mountain, whereas nobody else will even notice it. So when I talk to kids in high school, I say when you meet somebody coming home, a troop coming home from the war, there are two words that you use: thank you.
That's fact. We've got, I believe, Monday, the 333rd MPs out of Freeport, Illinois, is coming home, and I hope to be able to go up and give each one of them a hearty welcome and a hug. Tell them I love them, I'm proud of them.
I get chills even thinking about that. You've stayed pretty close to the troops. You did a tour over in the Balkans in 2000. Do I remember that?
Yes, sir. Told as many as I could how proud I was of them and gave them a hug. I just did for them what I would have wanted someone to do for me when I came home from Vietnam.
What precipitated that tour, or what brought it about?
Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen asked me if I wanted to go over, and I said, well, of course. And he made it happen.
You also, you were at a Navy SEAL Scout Sniper graduation class in February of 2002.
Yes, sir. I have had the privilege of addressing every graduating class since the late 90s.
I found this kind of interesting. You were with them on Friday. They had the graduation party. Then you were with them Saturday. And you said that, well, I guess on Friday, we sat up till 2:30 a.m. Sunday morning talking, and I tried to answer their questions. I really got to know them on a personal level, and this is the one thing that that really made me smile. They were asking you questions that they were too shy to ask you earlier.
The yes,
time
sir.
To imagine Navy SEALs, scout snipers, being shy.
They're just good kids.
There was a great story about the SEALs. It was don't remember if it was the Gulf War or this current war where they had to go in and take some platforms. It had to be this war because they were afraid that Saddam Hussein was going to blow up the platforms, the oil platforms out in the sea. They sent SEALs in there, and they captured the platforms without the platforms being blown up. And the Navy officer giving the briefing to the media, somebody asked him, how were they able to do that? And the guy stopped, and he with a puzzled look on his face, you know, like, what kind of a question is that? And he said, gentlemen, you have to understand, these are Olympic-class athletes with guns.
Most indeed.
We've got about 3.5 minutes left, and what would you like to talk about?
What would I like to talk about? I'd like to talk about our kids coming home, our troops. Sometimes when you call them kids, they become offended, and I don't mean that as in an offensive way, because they're my kids. All of them are my kids.
Right.
The duty, honor, country that's in the heart of all those young men and women that are serving and have served over there is just most excellent, and the highest praise goes to them.
You know, you were mentioned on an earlier program on Veterans Radio. It was something about the ethics of war. I can't remember it. A female officer from the Naval War College said that one of her most memorable moments was when you spoke to one of the classes and you said, an officer's duty is to see that his men don't lose their humanity.
Yes, sir. True to our own hearts.
You have a friend, and I have a friend named Michael J. Martin, and he said to me one time in talking about Mili, which was his unit a year earlier, and he said, I can understand the rage that would make you want to do it, but that's what you have officers for, to see that you don't.
Yes, sir.
And that ties in exactly with what you said. An officer's duty is to see that his men don't lose their humanity. When we're off to a war, we're there actually to rescue people, not to take territory.
And, sure, that's a fact.
And it's hard to lose to keep sight of the fact sometimes when the sheer weariness and the hunger and the loneliness, and, you know, the fright. You've experienced it. There had to be times when you didn't think that you could go on another step.
Most definitely, but you do. You don't lose till you quit trying. I learned that in Vietnam, and I have carried that with me the rest of my life, and that's what I try to share with all the young people that I speak to today, is the fact that no matter what you're faced with, truly, you don't lose till you get to that point where you go, I quit. And as long as you don't quit, you don't lose.
You got it. Sammy, I know that you held off on leaving for a trip, you and your wife, and to do this interview, and truly, truly do appreciate it. So thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio.
It's been an honor, sir. Thank you for everything that you do for our country and for our troops.
I can never do enough as far as I'm concerned. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Safe trip. Bye now. Bob, can you imagine doing the things that these people do, that Sammy did in that night?
Oh, yeah, Gary, that was quite a story. I'm glad that we also do our little welcome home, too, so,
yep.
You know, he was talking about getting hugs. Well, we do our welcome home.
Yeah, we do, and we're down at the end of the program next week. Who's coming up next week? Do you recall?
Not at the moment.
All right, we'll let you know next week.
Running the board.
We'll let you know next week. In the meantime, you are dismissed.
All programs are not part of or necessarily the views on this station or WDEO or Veterans Radio LLC.